By the time Edwin Rist stepped off the train onto the platform at Tring, 40 miles north of London, it was already quite late. The residents of the sleepy town had finished their suppers. The little ones were in bed. As he began the long walk into town, the Midland Line glided off into darkness. A few hours earlier, Edwin had performed in the Royal Academy of Music's London Soundscapes, a celebration of Haydn, Handel, and Mendelssohn. Before the concert, he'd packed a pair of latex gloves, a miniature LED flashlight, a wire cutter, and a diamond blade glass cutter in a large rolling suitcase, and stowed it in his concert hall locker. He bore a passing resemblance to a lanky Pete Townsend, intense eyes, prominent nose, and a mop of hair, although instead of shredding a Fender, Edwin played the flute. There was a new moon that evening, making the already gloomy stretch of road even darker. For nearly an hour, he dragged his suitcase through the mud and gravel skirting the road, under gnarly old trees strangled with ivy. Turlhanger's Wood slept to the north, Chestnut Wood to the south, fallow fields and the occasional copse in between. A car blasted by, its headlights blinding. Adrenaline coursing, he knew he was getting close. The entrance to the market town of Tring is guarded by a 16th century pub called the Robin Hood. A few roads beyond, nestled between the old Tring Brewery and an HSBC branch, lies the entrance to Public Footpath 37. Known to locals as Bank Alley, the footpath isn't more than 8 feet wide and is framed by 7-foot-high brick walls. Edwin slipped into the alley, into total darkness. He groped his way along until he was standing directly behind the building he'd spent months casing. All that separated him from it was the wall. Capped with 3 rusted strands of barbed wire, it might have thwarted his plans were it not for the wire cutter. After clearing an opening, he lifted the suitcase to the ledge, hoisted himself up, and glanced anxiously about. No sign of the guard. There was a space of several feet between his perch on the wall and the building's nearest window, forming a small ravine. If he fell, he could injure himself. Or worse, make a clamor that would summon security. But he'd known this part wouldn't be easy. Crouched on top of the wall, he reached toward the window with the glass cutter and began to grind it along the pane. Cutting glass was harder than he had anticipated, though, and as he struggled to carve an opening, the glass cutter slipped from his hand and fell into the ravine. His mind raced. Was this a sign? He was thinking about bailing on the whole crazy scheme when that voice, the one that had urged him onward these past months, shouted, "Wait a minute! You can't give up now! You've come all this way!" He crawled back down and picked up a rock. Steadying himself atop the wall, he peered around in search of guards before bashing the window out, wedging his suitcase through the shard-strewn opening, and climbing into the British Natural History Museum. Unaware that he had just tripped an alarm in the security guard's office, Edwin pulled out the LED light, which cast a faint glow in front of him as he made his way down the hallways toward the vault, just as he'd rehearsed in his mind. He wheeled his suitcase quietly through corridor after corridor, drawing ever closer to the most beautiful things he had ever seen. If he pulled this off, they would bring him fame, wealth, and prestige. They would solve his problems. He deserved them. He entered the vault, its hundreds of large white steel cabinets standing in rows like sentries, and got to work. He pulled out the first drawer, catching a waft of mothballs. Quivering beneath his fingertips were a dozen red-ruffed fruit crows gathered by naturalists and biologists over hundreds of years from the forests and jungles of South America and fastidiously preserved by generations of curators for the benefit of future research. Their coppery orange feathers glimmered despite the faint light. Each bird, maybe 1.5 feet from beak to tail, lay on its back in funerary repose, eye sockets filled with cotton, feet folded close against the body. Tied around their legs were biodata labels, faded, handwritten records of the date, altitude, latitude, and longitude of their capture, along with other vital details. He unzipped the suitcase and began filling it with the birds, emptying one drawer after another. The Occidentalis subspecies that he snatched by the handful had been gathered a century earlier from the Quindío Andes region of Western Colombia. He didn't know exactly how many he'd be able to fit into his suitcase, but he managed 47 of the museum's 48 male specimens before wheeling his bag onto the next cabinet. Down in the security office, the guard was fixated on a small television screen. Engrossed in a soccer match, he hadn't yet noticed the alarm indicator blinking on a nearby panel. Edwin opened the next cabinet to reveal dozens of resplendent quetzal skins gathered in the 1880s from the Chiriqui cloud forests of western Panama, a species now threatened by widespread deforestation and protected by international treaties. At nearly 4 feet in length, the birds were particularly difficult to stuff into his suitcase, but he maneuvered 39 of them inside by gently curling their sweeping tails into tight coils. Moving down the corridor, he swung open the doors of another cabinet, this one housing species of the Catinga birds of South and Central America. He swiped 14 100-year-old skins of the lovely Catinga, a small turquoise bird with a reddish-purple breast endemic to Central America, before relieving the museum of 37 specimens of the purple-breasted Catinga, 21 skins of the spangled Catinga, and another 10 skins of the endangered banded Catinga, of which as few as 250 mature individuals are estimated to be alive today. The Galapagos Island finches and mockingbirds gathered by Charles Darwin in 1835 during the voyage of the HMS Beagle, which had been instrumental in developing his theory of evolution through natural selection, were resting in nearby drawers. Among the museum's most valuable holdings were skeletons and skins of extinct birds, including the dodo, the great auk, and the passenger pigeon, along with an elephant folio edition of John James Audubon's The Birds of America. Overall, the museum houses one of the world's largest collection of ornithological specimens, 750,000 bird skins, 15,000 skeletons, 17,000 birds preserved in spirit, 4,000 nests, and 400,000 sets of eggs, gathered over the centuries from the world's most remote forests, mountainsides, jungles, and swamps.